This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's Radio Free Radio.
You're listening to Feminist Current, making waves in the mainstream. Welcome to Feminist Current. I'm your host, Megan Murphy. The feminist movement has been going strong for just about a century now. Women have advanced further than ever before. We're achieving better grades in college and university, and we're moving into the workforce and into traditionally male jobs at an increasing rate. But what about the men? Are men really falling behind? In Hannah Rosin's new book, The End of Men and the Rise of Women, she argues that as the world changed, women have adapted along with it, which, according to Rosin, has worked to their advantage, whereas men have failed to adapt, to their present and future detriment. Recently, Jennifer Omens, a historian and distinguished scholar in residence at New York University, published a review of Rosin's book in the New York Times. She writes, "The End of Men? This is not a title, it is a soundbite, but Hannah Rosin means it. The revolution feminists have been waiting for, she says, is happening now, before our very eyes. Men are losing their grip, patriarchy is crumbling, and we are reaching the end of 200,000 years of human history and the beginning of a new era in which women and womanly skills and traits are on the rise. Women around the world," she reports, "are increasingly dominant in work, education, households, even in love and marriage. The stubborn fact that in most countries women remain underrepresented in the higher precincts of power and still don't get equal pay for equal work seems to her a quaint holdover. The last artifacts of a vanishing age rather than a permanent configuration." End quote. I spoke with Jennifer Omens from her home in New York, and we'll hear that interview shortly. Later on the show, I talk with J.A. Martino about the trouble with situating women's liberation in hookup culture. J.A. is a feminist writer and choreographer who focuses on issues of gender performance, economics, and domestic labor. But first up is my interview with Jennifer Omens. In her book, The End of Men, Hannah Rosin says that for the first time in history, the global economy is becoming a place where women are finding more success than men. And I mean, in your opinion, is that in any way true? Like, are women as a whole really doing any better economically?
Well, I think, you know, that's almost an impossible question to answer in a general way. You know, there has to be very specific use of sociological material in order to really give a good answer to that question. And one of my objections to her book is that she uses a lot of studies, but they're not presented in a way that makes a convincing case. In fact, it's quite confusing. And, I mean, I think she admits even in the book that none of this is true for, you know, it's simply at the very top of most professions, women are still underrepresented. I mean, this is just something that we know. Are women gaining in areas like pharmaceutical? Maybe, yes, she presents some evidence that they are. Is that necessarily a step up? She also shows that you know, the family-owned pharmacy, which is where the men were in control of it in general, declined, and now these women are working for large corporations. So they don't own the pharmacies, but they're working in their employees. So, you know, are they better off? They may be making more money. It's not clear.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if they're working for those big corporations, then they're working for men, because those the people who would be running the corporations are still men for the most part.
And yet, presumably, that's right.
Mm-hmm. You know, we often hear, and, you know, there's a lot of information that shows that, women are the poorest of the world's poor, which, you know, kind of contradicts Rosen's claims that women are on the rise. But I wonder if you could maybe talk about what that statement or that idea means. So in what ways are women particularly impacted by poverty?
Well, look, I mean, the ways women are impacted by poverty are well known. I mean, they, you know, women are often in charge of households. They have a very hard time with nutrition, with child care, with taking care of families and being able to work at the same time. You know, none of those problems have changed, right? Mm-hmm. I don't see the change. I think what Rosen is trying to describe is a transformation in the face of the decline of the industrial working class. And she sees women slotting in medicine, in healthcare, in traditionally what she would call, you know, female-dominated practices that are now more and more in need, caretakers, teachers, nurses, that kind of thing. You know, it certainly may be true that women are coming forward and those things are being valued a bit more. Whether that's the rise of women, this seems a gross overstatement. And, you know, to pin the rise of women on, as she puts it, the end of men or the end of a particular subsection of the male working population at a particular moment in history, which have been well documented by others, and there have been many books written about them, is just not very original thinking. Mm-hmm. And it's not probably good for women to, the end of men is not a good thing for women. Mm-hmm. And the book has this strange contradiction, because she sort of doesn't want to say that, but she does end up saying that.
Yeah, and I mean, that's not, the goal of feminism isn't the end of men in any case, so it's misrepresenting on a number of levels, I would say.
It was too bad to me, because I think there are real issues that are raised by this book and by just contemporary research. You know, I mean, what are the real issues facing women today? There are a multitude of them, and they don't have to do with the end of men. Mm-hmm. And the global economy seems to me a facile category. I mean, the global economy is very complex and very unpredictable. And the ways in which that is changing the landscape for women is very mixed. And so her claims are a bit outsized. I mean, the real issues for women, right? I mean, if you want to talk about women at the top, right, the big debate that's been going on recently is the whole idea of can you have it all, right? And whether that was a foolish illusion to think that you might be able to have it all. I find that a kind of dead-end question in a way, because life is full of choices for men and women. And, you know, it's a sort of zero-sum game. You don't have enough time to do everything. So you have to make choices. Mm-hmm. Everybody has to make choices. I think what's different for women is that often their choices have more to do with children than men's. And so, you know, that puts them in a kind of double bind, mm-hmm. in feeling, if not in fact.
Yeah, I mean, choices happen within a context, and our choices are limited depending on, you know, class, race, gender, and all sorts of other issues, whether or not we have children and whatnot.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, then there's individuals. There are many men who have made decisions that we might identify as more classically the kinds of decisions that would face women. You know, they've decided to stay home, or they've decided to work less, or they've decided to balance their lives more effectively in terms of family and work and the other commitments that they have decided to put in their lives.
And, you know, so, you know, when we're talking about liberation, when we're talking about, you know, ending oppression of the oppression of women in a patriarchal society, do you think that just adding more women to the workforce will contribute to this goal? I mean, I wonder if you can talk a little bit more about what the problems are with focusing on, first of all, you know, middle-class American women as signifiers of the supposed rise of women, and as well, like, focusing on the workforce in general and the service economy as a signifier of the same.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's a limited model. You can't you can't draw global conclusions or universal conclusions from specific examples. I mean, I just, you know, it seems to me that the best books that deal with this are going to deal with it in a sort of considered and careful way, looking for the ambiguities, looking for the real complexity of the situation that's facing both women and men right now. I mean, I don't think feminism is over at all. I mean, women have lots of things that they are up against that are entrenched in the system. And you know, basic rights are, this is the point I tried to make at the end of my piece, you know, there is an argument to be made for focusing on politics right now and not on, you know, whether we are, and this, I suppose, was my strongest objection to her book, you know, was putting the essentialist argument at the center of things by saying women are essentially this way and men are essentially that way. Well, you know, there may be differences between men and women, but these are just cliches and stereotypes, and they don't really help us think through the kinds of challenges that are facing women. And if we're focusing on that, while at the same time, you know, legislatures and supreme and courts across the country are thinking about overturning basic legislation that supports, you know, the women's right to choose and labor laws, then what are we really doing? Are we missing something pretty big and reactionary that's going on across the culture, or at least that's threatening things that we had assumed were established in a mainstream kind of accepted way?
And, you know, I mean, some of the critiques that are coming out around Rosen's book have been made, you know, around liberal feminism before, that idea that women are simply equal to men in the public sector, then equality exists. And, I mean, did you find anything, is the end of men just more of the same, or did you find anything sort of new or relevant in her analysis?
Oh, I think she raises some important questions. You know, I tried to say that when I wrote about the book. You know, these are, you know, questions of shifts in the labor force, questions of the ways that men and women are doing in education, the whole question of the hookup culture and who that's good for and how it operates. Mm-hmm. You know, but her treatment of that is pretty shallow. I mean, it's basically just a flip and saying, well, actually, it's good for women, whereas before they said it's good for men, you know. So if you just flip it and say, well, it frees women for the same reasons that it frees men, I'm not sure that's really... You know, the deeper issue there is, what kind of human relationship does that culture create? Mm-hmm. And is that good for men or women? And, you know, what is the advantages? What are the very deep, I think, disadvantages? What is it saying about how we interact with each other as people, lovers, husbands, wives?
And what do you think those disadvantages are?
In the hookup culture?
Yeah. And the idea that women are empowered by this
hookup
culture.
I don't have anything, you know, terribly original to say about that. I just think it's a kind of, you know, we all, I shouldn't speak for everybody else, right? Lots of people like sex, and lots of people like eroticism, and lots of people don't want every encounter that they have be one that leads to a serious relationship or marriage. There's nothing new in that, right? But, you know, what seems to be the message here is that this kind of what we used to call one-night stands is somehow a good career move for women, and they get a certain amount of physical attention and satisfaction without taking on the time commitment. Everything's about time and efficiency, the time commitment that it would take to have a more involved relationship. Obviously, what gets left out of that is, well, what about the idea that this more involved relationship that took time could actually make you better at your work? And what about the idea that it would make you a more satisfied person, or that it's somehow a human deepening? And then I think, you know, I mean, this is where I always get caught in Rosen's book, because her own examples end up showing that that's really what people want in the end, you know? They're in search of it, even if they don't always get it, or even if they don't always want it. But there is a kind of sense that she's fighting against her own facts in order to push through a thesis.
You know, and finally, I mean, it seems like these kind of end of men pieces and articles are endlessly popular today. Why do you think that is?
Well, I don't know. I wonder, you know, the article by Anne-Marie Slaughter in The Atlantic, which, you know, followed some months later, apparently got a record number of, as they say, hits on the website. But it's a 30-some page piece with, it was quite serious. Just because it gets that many hits, does that mean everybody read the whole thing? I don't know. You know, how serious is the engagement with these so-called popular things that really engage you? I mean, The End of Men is a catchy title, right? And I'm not against catchy or sexy titles. Terrific. But it's so deliberately that way that it's reductive instead of enticing and seductive. But on that path towards reduction, then you're simplifying to the point of not adding to the conversation in a substantive way.
Okay, well, thank you so much. And I'm so glad that we got a chance to talk, and I really appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, and I really appreciate your call, and look forward to meeting you as well.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You're listening to Feminist Current. I'm Megan Murphy. Thanks so much to Jennifer Omens for speaking with me. You can read her review of Hannah Rosen's book, The End of Men, in the New York Times. Up next, I speak with friend of Feminist Current and J.A. Martino about some of the problems with Rosen's perspective on hookup culture. Is it liberating, or are we just fooling ourselves? J.A. is a feminist writer and choreographer living in Ontario. Here's that conversation.
So you wrote about Hannah Rosen's theory about hookup culture that she talked about in one of the chapters of her book for Feminist Current. And so I thought your analysis was totally on point. And I mean, I feel a little bit like we kind of went through this already, this kind of critique that was around this sexual revolution that happened in like the 60s or the 70s being completely empowering for women, and now women are free to have as much sex as they want without shame, and that's liberating. But from my perspective, I mean, first of all, it's not true that women can just be promiscuous or overtly sexual without judgment and shame, even though we, we work really hard to pretend that that's something that's happening, but that's not happening. And yeah, and there's all these other problems with that version of empowerment.
Totally. Like, it gets to me so much how people love talking about hookup culture and this whole feminine empowerment through sex is this like sexual free market, you know, where like, oh, everyone is just oh so free to like express who they are and everything's great and accepted. And I mean, to frame it as a conversation of like free versus unfree, right? You're like either free to have as much heterosexual, porn, imitate-y, performative sex as you like, or you're not free to have any sex whatsoever and you have to get married and like, or everyone will hate you and you're ruined or whatever. So like, if that's how it's going to be framed, then of course having promiscuous heterosexual sex is going to look like a better option. Mm-hmm. Right? But it's not like that. Like, this isn't, it should be actually a conversation about free versus fair, right? Free sexual market, like free speech or free trade or free market, like favors the powerful. It's about the individual. It's about choiciness, which of course is a function of privilege. And so hookup culture to me sort of embodies all, and that like whole liberation through sex in general is a very like individual choiciness sort of idea, and it doesn't sit very well with me because of that.
Yeah, and I mean, that's a super limited vision of freedom. I mean, of course that would be a positive thing if we were able to have sex without shame, but it's more complex than that. First of all, because not everybody wants to have sex, not everybody's heterosexual, and it plays into compulsory sexuality. So there's this culture wherein women feel like in order to truly be empowered and liberated women, they have to be having amazing sex all the time with men, and they have to be loving it, and they have to be having orgasms, and they have to be really sexual. And it's like, you know, I don't always feel like being sexual. It comes and goes in phases, and some people are asexual, and also like there's baggage, right, attached to our sexualities as women, and it's just not that easy.
For sure, but I do want to make the point that women's sexuality being brought into a like political realm was totally important. It was completely relevant. Female sexuality involves processes and consequences and stuff that have political weight, that are politicized and that are expensive. And so it's things that things that we need to talk about, right? Birth control, abortion access, childcare, all that stuff, which are issues faced by people with uteruses who may or may not identify as women. So, like, obviously it would be super important if everybody was able to perform their sexuality, but it's not like that. And I don't want to, like, ignore the work that was done by feminists before us, like second wave feminism, all that stuff is really important. It's not anybody's fault that those ideas were hijacked. Like, of course those ideas were hijacked. Of course they were. Appropriation is, like, the hallmark of oppression. Those things were never going to get away unscathed. But for sure the problem with this idea of liberation is that it's measured in how closely you hew to this particular idea of what is sexy, and that your sex also looks like that particular ideal, right? So, yeah, that involves maybe a lot of time and care and attention, and maybe unhealthy habits, and maybe all kinds of things. Maybe unhealthy high heels all the time, or plastic surgery, or hours on makeup, or crash diets, or any number of other things, but probably unhealthy relationships with your own body and with sex, from my own experience, and that didn't sound or feel like liberation to me.
No, and it's interesting, and I think we probably had similar experiences. I'm sure lots of women had similar experiences, just based on reading your critique of Hannah Rosen's vision of hookup culture, in that, you know, like, when I was young, when I was in my 20s, so, you know, she's talking about women, college-aged women.
Yeah.
So when I was that age, I thought that what would be empowering would be to be very promiscuous and, you know, do whatever I want and take charge, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, in retrospect, it wasn't liberating and it wasn't empowering because I was still kind of doing this performance, and because I didn't know what I wanted. So all that I could do was to emulate what I thought I was supposed to want, or to do whatever men wanted, you know, sexy girls to do, right? And it's like, and having promiscuous sex is fine, and you know, having one-night stands is fine, and sometimes that can be really fun, and I would never pass judgment on that at all. But at the same time, you know, there's something valuable in having sex with people that you know and trust, and, you know, building solid egalitarian relationships. And that's not to say that it has to be monogamous, but I think it just leaves out a lot. Like, it's this really simplistic, kind of like porny version of liberation that isn't true. And there's still a lot of shame attached, you know, those girls are still called sluts.
Sure, it's the burlesque slut walk, I'm not a feminist, I'm a slut version of female empowerment. And of course it's, like, riddled with problems, not the least of which, of course, is that it's highly privileged and cloistered and exclusive, right?
Mm-hmm.
Her article, for sure, that chapter in her book, she's talking about able-bodied, white, cisgendered, heterosexual, probably conventionally attractive women between the ages of 18 and 30. And like you were saying, that's our demographic as well, right? Those are experiences that we share. And this is the thing, there's a ton of value in talking about those experiences, and the fact that it only pertains to one particular, like, intersection of privilege and oppression, that one particular demographic, doesn't make it not worthwhile. Like, speak to what you know, you know? It's totally necessary to talk about those things, and one of the things that should be talked about is how that kind of male attention feels like power. Maybe it's not necessarily, we could talk about that would be relevant. But it becomes a problem when you then, like, extrapolate from that this must be the experience of all women everywhere. Oh, because I felt liberated for whatever reason by my promiscuous sex, then that means promiscuous sex is good for women.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you run into trouble, right? Because that's a pretty flaily wielding of a bunch of privileges.
Yeah, totally. And the fact that you might feel temporarily empowered by male attention, I mean, I think that idea comes up in a lot of different places. You mentioned burlesque. You know, when, for example, some people frame stripping as empowering because, you know, those women are getting paid and they have these men under their thumbs and they're the ones in charge and they're making all the decisions. And I get that. I get that that kind of thing can feel empowering, and I get that male attention and feeling in control of the sex that you're having with men can be really empowering. At the same time, it's temporary and it's only applicable to you. You know what I mean? So it is, it's very individualist, as you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, for sure. And like,
and I want women to feel good about themselves. I'm not saying that that's without value, because it is, it does have value, certainly.
Of course. And like, I think what we're talking about often gets critiqued as like, oh, we're framing all women as victims and no women can ever make a choice of any kind and blah, blah, blah. And that's like, obviously not what anybody's suggesting, but you make choices not in the vacuum of space, you know. You make choices within a society that sends you messages of one kind or another, and, like, it's no coincidence that this particular society sends messages like, getting your boobies out for dudes is empowering. Even when the reality, often, like, if we're talking about stripping or pornography in particular, like, obviously the reality of that situation bears no resemblance to the mythological narrative of empowerment that it's given.
Yeah, and I mean, we still live in a culture where there's this Madonna whore dichotomy, and where women are sent crazy mixed messages around the fact that they're supposed to be really sexual, but not too sexual. And, you know, now I'm in my 30s, and I still have, all of that stuff is still there for me, as much as I understand it all, and as much as I've, you know, matured and gotten to know myself better and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, it's really hard to get rid of all that stuff, and it's because it's ever present in our society. And so, as you said, you know, we can't just pretend that we're functioning in some kind of cultural vacuum where all this stuff doesn't exist, and we can just suddenly do whatever we want whenever we want. And if we feel good about it, then that's it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm partnered and have been for like 5 or 6 years, so I worry less about that particular side of things, but I catch myself all the time worrying about like, oh, I'm 30 now and I'm just going to get older and like my youth and beauty is behind me and like what if men don't check me out anymore, and like that, I feel real sadness when I think about not being looked at in that way anymore. Mm-hmm. And that's ridiculous, right? Because There's no real power in that. Like, the fact that it could happen one day and the next day and the next day, and then you pass a certain age and it doesn't happen anymore, is indicative of exactly how not powerful that power is. But I want it nonetheless, you know?
Yeah, and it's interesting because I'm single now, and I was in relationships for about 5 years in a row, and so I kind of thought I was over all that stuff. And I was like, oh god, it's still there.
It's still there. Because so, I still live in the world.
Yeah, so it's like, I go out on dates and I still, my brain tells me that I'm supposed to play these games. Like,
yeah.
I'm supposed to sort of pretend like I don't want to have sex or like hold off.
Or maybe you have to pretend like you really do want to have sex and then you don't care and then no strings or
be
whatever.
Sexy and not too sexy all at the same time, and it's like, oh man, nothing's changed since I was 20. That sucks. I guess we should wrap up soon, but I mean, I also wanted to mention this one idea, that because I think this I haven't actually read Rosen's book yet. I'm waiting for it. It's coming to me in the mail, but it seems like there's this like thread running through her whole critique or analysis. In particular, this hookup culture aspect that I had wanted to talk to you about. And that's that idea that comes up a lot within liberal feminism, wherein equality is about women being more equal to men. It's mm-hmm. about women being more like men. So mm-hmm. if women can just get into these positions that men are in right now, these positions of power, if they can get into the workforce the way that men are, if they can have sex like men and act like men and be confident or be aggressive like or be strong like men, then we'll have achieved equality. And I think that's really inaccurate and
like pretty sexist also.
Yeah, like it's like,
like we'll listen to you like if you men. Just act more like us.
Yeah, I don't know. So, yeah, what do you think about that idea?
I see all that. You said something once that I thought was so awesome. It was so insightful. You'd written about a conversation on pornography where there's a producer called herself a feminist pornographer, and she was saying, like, oh, I make sure to have people of color and all these other, like, diverse groups in my pornography, and you were like, yeah, great, we'll just oppress everybody equally, objectify everybody equally the same way. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was so insightful, and also how I feel about a lot of this. You know, there are all these problems and inequalities in the structure itself. And the idea is that if we can just jam enough people into it, no matter how well they fit, then somehow that will look like equality. And for me, and for a lot of other people, obviously it has to go much deeper than that, much deeper than liberal feminism is willing to go, which is, of course, why the mainstream media likes liberal feminism so much, because it doesn't challenge anything. It just wants to play along.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's like, we're not talking about issues of class and capitalism. Yeah. It's like, everybody join in, and then there'll be more women in positions of power where they can marginalize other women. it just doesn't add up.
Yeah.
But anyway, I think we've ran out of time here, so it was really great to talk with you.
Cool. Yeah, you too. I'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye.
That's all the time we have for today. Thanks to Jennifer Omens and to J.A. Martino for speaking with me about Hannah Rosen's new book, The End of Men. I'm Megan Murphy. Thanks for tuning in to Feminist Current. Feminist Current is a syndicated show produced by Megan Murphy out of Vancouver, BC, Canada. For more information on the show, please visit www.feministcurrent.com. If your station would like to air Feminist Current, you can find episodes at audioport.org or email us at info@feministcurrent.com.